It is return of the scorekeeper, David Feldman, historian and television producer, in a special crossover episode with Locked On A's. This is Locked On MLB.
You are Locked On MLB. Your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans. Welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. This episode, which is being dropped on the 14th day of January 2022, we are going to be playing an episode which I produced for Locked On A's and now playing here for Locked On MLB, where I spoke again with A's historian and Major League scorekeeper and television producer David Feldman about his thoughts of the A's stretching from Philadelphia right till present day. This show is available on all your free podcasting apps. Thanks so much for making us your first listen. We'll have your second listen be Locked On A's with the great Jason Burke, who I pinch hit for several times over the last few weeks. As congratulations to him, he's a brand new papa. His baby is too old to play for the A's as they're going for a youth movement, but congratulations all the same. Follow us on Locked On MLB Pods on both Twitter and Instagram. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. So David Feldman appeared on an episode shortly before the new year, and I had played part of that for Locked On MLB. Another part of the conversation originally aired on a couple of days ago on Locked On A's. I produced that for Jason so he could have some episodes under his belt as he's a brand new papa. And while my life has caught up with me a little bit, I'm sorry I haven't had an episode to drop for the last few days, I decided to play you part of this and have it part of the Locked On MLB feed for those of you who don't subscribe to Locked On A's. And this is a wonderful conversation. We played, as I said, the first part of it with David Feldman a few weeks ago on Locked On MLB. This part is very much A-centric, but I think you'll enjoy the conversation. We talk a lot about history, where we were, and, well, some of the ways that A's history could have been a lot different. So enjoy this part of the conversation with David Feldman.
We're here with TV producer and baseball historian David Feldman. You've been connected with the Oakland A's starting in the early 90s, which is a hell of a good time to be connected to the Oakland A's. You were witness to a team that I thought was on the verge of becoming a dynasty. But certainly, look at nothing, no shame in the run that they had. Three straight trips to the World Series, another trip to the postseason, back when that was much harder to do. And, man, you talk about the two times they lost the World Series. Those are two of the greatest upsets in baseball history. Was 88 is the greatest upset because that Dodger team that they fielded was a minor league or was just like the B squad of a traveling spring training game. Yeah. And the Reds who won, you know, the story in 1990, which might be apocryphal, that the 89 World Series was obviously a dud. I mean, it had the horrible earthquake in the middle of it, and the series itself was not competitive. The Giants didn't have the lead for even a single inning.
It was a fantastic four games. I love those four games. They were my favorite four games.
Let me tell you something about that World Series. I was living in Palo Alto. My family had already moved to the Bay Area. I'm living in Palo Alto. My father, diehard Giants fan, back when they were the New York Giants, we moved to California. He's put his Giants hat on. And he's re-embracing the team of his youth. Okay. And for those of you who don't understand, the Bay Area had been wanting a Giants-A's World Series forever. And that you had all these great stars on the Giants, all these great stars on the A's. They never connected. 71, they were both in it, playoffs. They didn't meet the World Series. And so now that finally was happening, A's, Giants, and as a baseball fan, as an outsider, I was rooting for the Giants because of my dad. And I also didn't like the fact that the A's clobbered the Red Sox in 88. And there was so much excitement. And And then the earthquake hits. And then there's no baseball for like, was it 11 days, I think, something like that. 10 days. Yeah. Okay. And I was actually setting up a videotape in, I was a senior in high school, setting up a videotape for my dad. So, cause he was still at work. So I was setting up a videotape so he could see the opening at Candlestick Park when the earthquake hit. And we, believe me, we felt it in Palo Alto. And when the 10 days had passed, the A's and Giants resumed, and the A's brought back Dave Stewart to pitch game three. He had pitched game one. I think he threw a complete game shutout in game one.
He did.
And then he came back to pitch game three. And my buddy Greg, who is a rabid Giant fan, been waiting his whole life to see the Giants in the World Series, saw they were starting Dave Stewart. And I remember him banging the table saying, they shouldn't be allowed to do that. Why are they allowing them to do that? I said, well, because he's on 10 days rest. Wouldn't you do that? And it was just, they just started Stewart Moore. It was just.
Yeah. No, so I was all four of those games. So I grew up an A's fan. My dad was a Philadelphia A's fan.
Oh,
and
wow.
We actually moved to the Bay Area in 68. Yeah, my dad used to yell at Connie Mack. And then we got to yell at Tony La Russa together. So that was, yeah, that's a bonding moment.
It's good to bond that way.
So I, you know, huge A's fan, loved, you know, Billy Martin, and then these late 80s A's with Canseco and McGuire and Stu and bringing Ricky back. And yeah, that World Series for me, because I have an irrational hate of the Giants. I grew up hating the Giants. Mm-hmm. Just because that's, you know, you're a kid, you pick sides.
That's what you
right?
do. Yeah, pick sides.
And so, you know, that World Series and having the A's win after coming off the heartbreak of 88, which was just mm-hmm. awful, you know, winning in 89, winning the way they did, remembering the Giants, you know, even before I was a Candlestick for the earthquake. And, mm-hmm. you know, that day was so warm.
It was a beautiful.
Remember
day,
the
yeah.
fans were all there. They were so excited because Don Robinson, you know, was going to be able to bat. And that was going to help the offense, right? The A's were going to lose the DH and Don Robinson was going to be able to bat. And Ken Overfeld.
And they were starting Welch in three and Davis in four. And so yeah. they didn't have the huge, like Moore and Stewart were better than you know, Gerelts and I think it was Rushel were starting. Yeah. And so the A's had the advantage there, but it was not the same advantage in games three and four. And there was this sense of, okay, the Giants' bats were dead in Oakland. They only scored one run in Oakland. But they can score off of Davis. They can score off of Welch. They can get this offense started. And the Giants' bats were potent, and they were a little bit dead. And then the quake hit.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about that game three, the original game three, one, it was so warm out there. And during batting practice, Ken Phelps was hitting balls in the upper tank at Candlestick. The ball was just flying. And yes, and Bob yeah. Welch was scheduled to start that game. Bob Welch was yeah. not going to start the game. He was hurt. Kurt oh, Young really? Was going to start game three.
No, I never knew that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for those of you, Kurt Young was a classic. Those of you who don't remember, I know you do, but like, you know, forgive me, not everyone is going to know who Kurt Young is. Kurt Young was a classic left-handed spot starter, swingman, long reliever, yeah. you know, a decent pitcher, you know, could win some games for you. He probably would have been in the starting rotation for the Rangers, you know, for a yeah. team that wasn't as good. And he was just good depth. They had two pitchers, Kurt Young and Todd Burns, who would yeah. probably be starters on any other team. And instead what they did is they were kind of like what Romero Mendoza was when he was with the Yankees in the late 90s, early 2000s. And what Lincecum did in the 2012 World Series was he was kind of a bridge pitcher
yeah.
and, you know, would get his spot starts. And the idea of a left-handed Kurt Young pitching against Mitchell, Williams,
Robbie Met, Thompson,
you know, Will Clark, obviously Robbie Thompson, Candy Maldonado. Who was the center fielder? Was Brett Butler? I mean, there was some pop on that team, and just good smart hitters. Yeah, the Giants would have won that game.
they could have. No, the A's were so much better than the Giants that it wasn't going to matter who they threw. The A's offense, especially, it really clicked in halfway through September. The A's offense in Cleveland, it just took off. And from mid-September through October, that A's offense was as good as can be. And you look at that lineup now and you go, okay, Ricky, Carney, Jose, Parker, McGuire, Hendu, Steinbach. And then you get to your middle infielders at the end, right? Whether it's Tony Phillips, who was on fire.
Underrated, really underrated player.
Unbelievable. And then Walt Weiss, who also homered in the World Series. That offense wasn't going to stop. Yeah, and they were just clicking. And it's really the 89 A's, they don't get their due as one of the greatest teams. And they were. They by far were. Because the pitching, the bullpen, you know, set up with Honeycutt and Nelson, ending with Eckersley. And then you talk about Todd Burns, who was so effective in that swingman role. Ron Hassey is your backup catcher. It just Stan Javier couldn't see the field. But Stan Javier was a good player in a long major league career.
Stan Javier would have been a starting center fielder of a playoff team at that time. And he was basically a late inning defense replacement pinch runner, but who are you going to replace? You're not going to place Endu. You're not going to place Canseco. You're not going to place Ricky Henderson. No. You know, the previous year when they had kind of a rotation, they had Louis Polonia and Javier, and sometimes Parker would play the outfield. Sometimes Tony Phillips would play the outfield. Yeah. But once they got Ricky back in the trade in June, I think it was June or July, June they got him back from the
89. Yeah.
Shortly before the opening of Batman, the that's how I judge time is baseball and when movies open. But you know, Ricky Henderson. Let's see if I can remember the trade. The A's traded him to the Yankees, and Javier was part of the trade. I'm doing this from memory. Javier was the Yankee outfielder they got back from him, along with Jose Rio and Jay Howell. And I think Tim Burtsis. I could have been the trade. I know Howell came to the A's in the Ricky trade. I know Javier came there. I know Jose Rio came from there.
Yeah. Rio was the big get for that.
Yeah. And Rio, ironically, won the World Series MVP against the A's because Rio was the big chip when they traded for Dave Parker in Cincinnati. Again, yes. I'm doing some of this from memory.
So the first trade was in December of 84. It was Ricky and Burt Bradley, who was a minor league pitcher, for Burtsis, Hal, Stan Javier, Eric Plunk, and Jose Rio.
Oh, I didn't realize Eric Plunk came in that deal. Okay. Oh, I did. Oh, but I got the other ones in there.
Yeah.
But then Plunk was sent back to the Yankees.
Was sent back.
Along with Greg Cotteret and Louis Polonia.
Yeah.
Because that was when the Yankees were actually pretty bad.
They were terrible.
They thought they were getting a starter in Plunk, and I think they started Cotteret but they also knew Polonia could be he could fill Ricky's role, and there's a big difference between Ricky Henderson and Louis Polonia.
Could he be their leadoff guy?
Louis Polonia had a nice career, was a solid player. Not exactly Ricky Henderson.
No,
but. But that year, if I remember correctly, the Angels were in first place for a giant chunk of that year because there was the A's went through a ton of injuries.
Yeah, they didn't have Jose for the first half of the year. Jose had the first ever Hammett bone. He broke the Hammett bone, so he missed the first half. And then Eckersley got hurt in May.
That's right.
Basically from mid-May to the All-Star break. And then they get him back and – you know, again, they add Ricky. Everything starts to gel. It takes a little while, but I'm telling you, from the middle of September on, unstoppable.
Yeah, in fact, I am going to go to baseballreference.com, the single greatest website in the history of the planet Earth, and I am going to just check something out here because if I remember correctly, I remember Tim Burtsis was involved in the trade, so I'm giving myself a little bit of credit that I can remember some of these things. But if I remember correctly, the California Angels, back when they were in California before they moved to Los Angeles and Anaheim, they were in – okay, I'm jogging my memory a little bit here that the A's and the – okay, it wasn't quite as I remember because the A's and the Angels – the Angels, A's were in first for most of the year, but it was all summer long. It was really only a game and a half or two games separated the two. They were like really – back and forth, and it looked like they were going to be going down the stretch with a great pennant run. And then when all the A's were healthy, they wound up winning the division by seven games.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of a cat playing with a little toy ball of yarn.
Okay, let's take a quick break to talk about Bet Online, the number one spot for all the best sports wagering action for 2022. New year and new updated desktop and mobile website to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code LOCKEDON to get started. From football, basketball, hockey, boxing, UFC, and your favorite Las Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for 2022. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports. BetOnline, it's where the game starts.
It's funny, you brought up, we're here with David Feldman, TV producer, A's fan, been there, done that, and comes from a good, solid A's lineage, as his father was a Philadelphia A's fan. I mentioned this in another podcast. It is strange that when you look at the A's history, the Athletics should be a Philadelphia institution, the same way the Tigers are in Detroit, the same way the Cardinals are, the same way the Red Sox are, and in Boston. And it's odd when you think about how nondescript the Phillies were and how wonderfully colorful and dynamic the A's were, that it was the A's who left Philadelphia and not the Phillies. I believe fervently, and you had mentioned this man's name earlier in the podcast, I believe fervently that Connie Mack and his decision to not step down when he was way too old to be managing the team, but he owned the team, and his cousins, or his his sons, who were all a bunch of Fredos, were basically running the team while setting up their aging pop supposedly as the manager. I think that irreparably damaged the team. They never were able, they seemed to be more interested in winning one more for Connie, and there was like decades where they were completely unwatchable in Philadelphia. And by the time it was clear that the city can only support one team, the Phillies had the Whiz Kids, and they suddenly got good, and the A's stunk, and so the A's went off to Kansas City to become basically a farm team for the Yankees.
Yeah.
And I just can't help but wonder that if around 36 or 37, when it was clear Connie Mack was done, if he had stepped down and someone else had taken over the team, if the A's would still be in Philadelphia and we'd be talking about the Oakland Phillies.
Well, what's interesting about this A's franchise now, you know, after 121 seasons, it's the same story. You get a team that gets to be very good, but they're still running on a shoestring budget. It's not sustainable. They have to sell off their players, and they become very bad. Right? This happened with Connie twice. And when they got bad the second time, they couldn't get better. Baseball was starting to pass by Connie Mack, as you said. He needed to get out of there. All of a sudden, the African-American players were coming in. The A's were a little late to that. Much the American League was late to that. The A's were part of that as well. And then by then, the finances were done. They had no money, and they had to sell the team. They sell them to Arnold Johnson, who moves them to Kansas City, thinking that this is going to be great. And like you said, they basically become a Yankee farm team, where anything the Yankees wanted, Arnold Johnson was happy to give them. From Roger Maris to Joe DeMaestri, whatever they needed, he was going to give it to them.
It's amazing when you look at how many – the Yankees' top farm team used to be in Kansas City. I think they were the Kansas City were they the Royals? I can't remember. But anyway, it was their AAA number one team was in KC. And when the A's moved there, they just made trades with the A's as if they were their minor league team.
Basically,
when they got a bunch of veterans who they were done with, they would just trade them to KC for their young players, and then those young players would end up with the Yankees. And when Cleveland had Roger Maris, and they traded him to Kansas City, there were so many people up in arms in baseball saying, like, you idiots, you're basically trading him to the Yankees. That he's going to – when you send him there, he's going to wind up in New York. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And one of the things that when Charlie O'Finley took over the A's when they were still in Kansas City. Charlie Finley, who was the single strangest and most flamboyant owner probably in baseball history, with possible exception of Bill Veeck, he did grandiose displays of public theater. And one of the things he did is he lit a bus on fire in Kansas City, because there was this joke that the Kansas City just had a bus to, was just a bus to New York. So he lit a damn bus on fire to signify that we're done making deals with the Yankees. It's a new era, and I'm going to keep the A's in Kansas City forever, and then try to move them to every single city in creation.
Yeah, get out as quick as you can. But you know, Charlie, and he was crazy but brilliant in his way. I mean, he made his money by figuring out insurance plans for doctors and nurses, something that had never been done before, and he makes a fortune on that. He was definitely a showman, a huge ego, and you have to be, right? That style. We see that with Jimmy Jones now. We saw that with Steinbrenner. And he always thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. And with his baseball acumen, surprisably very high. His talent forecasting was pretty amazing. And he also could see what was happening labor-wise in baseball. You know, it was Charlie's idea to say, make them all a free agent at the end of the year. Make them all a free agent. You flood the market, right? And you're going to keep prices down. The other owners couldn't see it. Marvin Miller knew it. He knew that would destroy anything he was building. Mm-hmm. And the other thing Charlie knew, that arbitration was going to kill him. He knew. Charlie said, you can't agree to arbitration. It's going to artificially inflate prices. You have no idea this is going to kill this game. He saw it coming before anybody else. But nobody listened to him because he was crazy. He was Charlie, right? Yeah. He was the one who, you know, helped push for night games of the World Series, which that's all we have now is night games. And that's one of the reasons we have so much money in the pot, because of these night games and the way TV money works. And he also obviously pushed for the designated hitter, something that originally came up much earlier in baseball's history, actually as a National League idea. But Charlie pushed for it, and then he went a little too far pushing the designated runner, the orange baseballs. He even got the three balls and two strikes in an exhibition game one year. But he, you know, for all his craziness and his cheapness, and he was very cheap because he didn't have a lot of money to spend to begin with, he was very prescient about where the game was going.
Well, you mentioned a lot of great things there. I mean, he was pushing very hard for a DH. He pushed very hard for divisional play. He also pushed hard for a realignment. He wanted to have division. He said, why aren't the Giants and the A's in the same division? Yeah. Why aren't the Yankees and the Mets or the Dodgers and the Angels? These are natural rivals. We're ignoring these. And all, you know, a lot of his ideas were poo-pooed and then later implemented. Famously, Marvin Miller was terrified of him because he was smart enough to see the way, okay, you want free agency? You got it. You've all got it. That's what you fought for. And that the other owners were too stupid to see that if you just had a little stream of players who were available, that made the supply and demand in favor of the players. But you're right that his baseball acumen and his baseball IQ in many ways was through the roof, because he had a bare-bones scouting department. Yep. He basically was the GM. He fired GM every hour on the hour. And who did he bring in? He brought in Vida Blue, Reggie Jackson, Bert Campanaris, Sal Bando, Joe Rudy, Raleigh Fingers, Rick Monday, who he flipped for Ken Holtzman. That great dynasty he had, so much of it was homegrown. That core he had were people that he, and if you read, like I've been reading a lot about his relationship with Catfish Hunter and his relationship with Vida Blue and Blue Moon Odom, this was before the draft. So he had to recruit them the way a college coach would have to recruit a star quarterback. And he did it masterfully. So by the time they up and moved from Kansas City to Oakland, he had already a core of the team that would go on to be the only team other than the Yankees to win three straight World Series.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break to talk a little bit about Built Bars. It's the new year, New Year's resolution. It's about getting fit and eating healthier. Make sure you include Built Bars in your plan. It's the protein bar that tastes like a candy bar, maybe even better than a candy bar. makes it easy to stick your resolution because they taste so good, you'll want to eat it. Unlike other protein bars, which can be chalky, waxy, or taste like a chemical spill, you'll want to have the Built Bars because you say, I want to eat healthy, but where's my chocolate? Built Bars got the chocolate. And they contain, most of them, 130 calories, 4 grams of sugar, 4 grams net carbs, and 17 grams of protein. Compare that to a candy bar, 240 calories, 30 grams of sugars, so many net carbs, not worth it. And guess what? There's so many great flavors. Whether you like coconut and almond, peanut butter brownie, cookies and cream, salted caramel, mint brownie, my personal favorite is raspberry, many, many more. Built is coming up with new limited time flavors all the time. So check out built.com and see what's new. Go to built.com and use promo code LOCK15 to get 15% off your order. Use promo code LOCK15 for 15% off at built.com.
All right, let's get back to the interview with David Feldman, A's historian and television producer.
And he also saw with free agent coming that he wasn't going to be able to afford any players. So he tries to sell Joe Rudy and Raleigh Fingers and Vita Blue. Right? He actually does sell them. And he was going to use the money to help restock the farm system. Bowie Kuhn strikes it down.
Yeah.
Not in the best interest of baseball. But he saw what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk a lot about the early 70s A's. He also drafted Mike Norris, Ricky Henderson, Dwayne Murphy. I mean, the core of the Billy Ball team, he also had a big hand in that. He did have an eye for baseball talent.
It was really, it's really amazing. I mean, he's a source of never ending fascination for me. Like, I mean, I've read three biographies on the man, and one of the ones was talking about how he was offended that a writer said he was humorless. And so he called the writer and told him a joke dryly. Yeah, they terribly told a joke over the phone and said, now you can't say I'm humorless. And okay. But like, he loved to use the press.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, it he talked about someone who'd be terrified to have had a Twitter account,
social media. I knew.
But he used the press and used, getting this reporter to, write something bad about this, player, that player, to sort of prod them. And he would, he was so borderline obsessed to have his name being said during the broadcast, to the point where Monty Moore would get these notes. Monty Moore was the longtime announcer for the, I know you know this, but the longtime announcer for the A's. And he would get little notes saying like, make sure they know about the donkey, make sure they know about this, and make sure they know that Charlie Finley came up with this. And he would kind of crumple it up and just call the game and then get reprimanded. Yeah. And for one season, Harry Carey was an announcer for the A's. People think he was with the Cubs forever. He actually, most of his career was with the Cardinals and the big chunk of the White Sox. But he, for a little bit, he was signed by Charlie O'Finley. And Charlie Finley tried to get him to say holy mule instead of holy cow, because Charlie Finley had a mule that he would ride around the stadium. For some reason, he thought this was the funniest thing in the world. Look, that's Charlie Owen. I don't understand why he thought it was so funny. But the interesting thing is that when he was in Kansas City, this is just, I love alternate universe stuff. And he was on the verge of, in fact, there was a press release that he was on the verge when they were in Kansas City, he was going to move into Louisville.
Yeah.
And they were going to be renamed the Kentucky Colonels. And that way he wouldn't have to buy a new hat. They could still use the KC on the hat. He could save money on that. The green and gold were his color ideas. And they came out in these bright green and bright gold uniforms, to the point where in one of the All-Star games, I forget which manager it was, but they wouldn't play the player from the A's because they were too embarrassed to send this player out into uniform. But he toyed with the idea of moving them to Seattle. He played footsie with Dallas. It looked like for a while Dallas was going to be the team to go. Atlanta, he played footsie with. Played footsie with New Orleans. And even by the time he got to the A's, they thought, oh, he's going to move to Denver. He's going to move to New Orleans. He's going to move to here. He's going to move to there. And, I mean, the Oakland was almost a cameo.
Yeah.
For the A's.
Yeah, it was going to be a quick stop. World
Series and, yeah. Quick stop, mm-hmm. and then off they went.
I always, being around the A's and working with the late, great Ray Fosse for over 30 years, and he would tell me Finley stories and other people who were around the ball club. And one of my favorite things was, so when they hired MC Hammer, Stanley Burrell, mm-hmm. as the executive vice president.
And this when MC Hammer was like, what, 10 years old?
Like he was like 13 years old, right? Yeah, so saw him dancing in the by the BART tracks, basically. So he would have MC Hammer on the phone during games, doing the play-by-play over the phone, so Charlie can listen in Chicago. He liked having MC Hammer. And MC Hammer, he would, you know, he colorful language, he'd tell the story, the whole thing. Charlie loved it. Well, there was a homestand that where MC Hammer couldn't be there, so Jack McKeon, who would later on be a great manager. At this point, he had already been fired once as manager of the A's, but he was still working for the club. Jack McKeon gets on the phone, and he's going to give the play-by-play. And he's just ball, strike. And Charlie's yelling at him with, no, you got to do it like MC Hammer does it. You got to give me the whole story. He's yelling at him over the phone because he's not doing it like MC Hammer.
Yeah, and that sounds like a Mad Lib. That Charlie O'Finley was mad at Jack McKeon for not doing play-by-play like MC Hammer. But, you know, that's how weird the A's were. And for those of you who don't know, MC Hammer got his nickname. I believe it was Reggie Jackson who dubbed him that. But it was certainly one of the players. I think it was Reggie.
Yeah.
Because he felt that Stanley Burrell looked like Henry Aaron. And Henry Aaron was Hammer and Hank, the Hammer. And so, therefore, every time you heard Hammer or Hammer Time, that is a sly reference to Hank Aaron.
Yeah, and they got their picture taken together when Henry was with the Brewers. He came in and they got their picture, and they do look, especially young MC Hammer, looked a lot like him. And then when MC Hammer decided he was going to start his music career, it was actually Ricky Henderson and Mike Davis who helped finance his first record and helped get him on his way. So a big tie to the A's, and he's always been pretty very – you know, always an A's fan, but has always been very grateful for what the A's did for him in his career.
If I remember the Too Legit to Quit video, his backup dancers were wearing A's warm-up jackets.
They were. There were some nice green satin A's jackets. They were very sweet.
Thanks so much, David Fellman. Thanks so much, Jason Burke. Congratulations again on being a new papa. And thanks for you for making Locked On MLB your first listen. And have your second listen be Locked On A's. Maybe your third listen be Locked On Bets with your boy Q and expert analysis from Lee Sterling. This has been Locked On MLB for the 14th day of January, 2022. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.